none of us, at least of my way of thinking, and we were the majority in IBS, that got along very well with Fred, as I recall. He had a different crowd that he went with. And he knew all the people in the program office, which was the CIA's cover and the AID compound there, and the MAG people, the military people and all this. And he made no secret of that. He didn't want to talk about CIA. I mean, he would deny that. But anyway.
But you knew where he was going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've always wondered where he ended up, but I'm sure probably somewhere in that direction. Anyway, so I flew out of there very quickly, and I was then assigned to Mung Cao, which was a village cluster program. We had, I think it was 16 villages, 14 or 16 villages. Val Peterson and I and Terry Collins, the three IBS people.
I don't know Collins, but Peterson is now in San Diego.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah,
I've seen him out there. I went and visited him, and he's selling insurance out there, and he's married to a woman, to a Lao woman. And he's exactly the same old Val that I always knew, and a wonderful guy. And I really learned a great deal from Val, working with him. And he was much more mature, obviously, than I was at that time.
Well, a little bit older.
And so what we had a house there, a very nice house on Lao standards, and a compound that we had there. And
I was wondering where that was.
Mung Cao was near Pak San, about which is on the on the Mekong, sort of where the country bends down.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
South of Vientiane, a little bit. North from Ta Kek, if that helps you.
No, the bend in the river.
But Pak San is right across from Thailand, literally right across the river. In fact, they used to, in those days, when they had the boat races, which were sort of very legendary, they used to shoot fireworks and try and reach the other shore, because they used to say, we shoot at the Thai, because they didn't get along, and there was always these Thai, drunken Thai soldiers that used to run across the Mekong, and I mean, you know, come across in boats and raid the villages and rape the women, and then they'd be gone, you know. And that later became sort of a sanctuary for the CIA-supported forces against the Pathet Lao, who were in and out of Laos, but they largely had a sanctuary in Thailand, which was, again, CIA-supported operation. And they were doing the same thing, raping the women and, you know, shooting up a village and kill. They love to kill children and so forth. Poisoning every now and then, poisoning the wells and so forth. It was really ugly. So what we did in Mung Cao was basically distributing fertilizer, insecticide, and seeds, vegetable and rice, and built a school there. We worked with the villages building, and my particular thing was building, helping people building water seal latrines and wells with these
rings?
Cement rings. You know, right. In fact, the picture that's in this thing, if I can find it, magic, stop it, is of me on one of these well projects. And, you know, we worked with these, it's either 14 or 16 villages, so we were constantly on the move, you know, and back and forth all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Had a Jeep supplied by AID, and, you know, one of these old World War II Jeeps, that, but they worked, and we worked very hard. I mean, it was not an easy job, but we enjoyed it. again, with Val as sort of our leader, and Terry and I were the volunteers, and well, Val was a volunteer, obviously, but he was sort of the three of us, the guy in charge.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't really see it that way. I mean, we were all treated each other very equally, and it was a very close working situation. And the one thing we had to do was twice a day use the sideband, single sideband radio to check in with Vientiane. You know, it was a very routine thing. And
that was routine, but could it be information that could be used by other people other than just IVS? This is,
we didn't say very much on the radio. I mean, unless there was a really, I mean, some thing out of the ordinary, you know, emergency situation or whatever. But basically, it was, you know, everything's okay, and we were expected to call in between, I think it was 8 and 8.30 and 5 and 5.30 or whatever it was. But you're right. I mean, there was certainly grounds there for and room for a space for misuse of that. And I'm sure the radio was listened to both by the PL and by the Lao military. I'm assuming, at least, I had no way of knowing that, but goes with the territory.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that, considering where this location was, it hardly was in a, from what I understand, a forward area.
No, but it wasn't far from, I should get a map out and show you, because it wasn't that far from not a forward area as such, but PL territory.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because we had one case where somebody came to us and said there's somebody very, very sick in this place, and Val and I...
In one of the 16 villages?
No.
Even further away?
Out of our territory.
Okay.
And the question is, what do we do? And so we drove through the mountains over a very bad road. Took us hours and hours to get there, and mm-hmm. it was in an area that was definitely PL, mm-hmm. not that Lao controlled.
Uh-huh.
And so we, I mean,
so it's not that
we
far.
Didn't check with Chet, should we do this or not? I mean, yeah. Lao said we're doing it. It's a humanitarian thing to do.
Let's get this back on. So,
so
really, you really were kind of close. You know, I've often wondered if, you know, why people really needed those. Because when I was in the Philippines, I was 40 kilometers from the road, but never felt the need for a radio.
Yeah, but that was the Philippines before, at least, there was major problems.
Well, yeah, but I had NPA in my barrio.
Yeah.
So. Oh, well, let me pause it while you look here.
It was never really discussed in terms of what the protocol or what to do in a situation like this, but had we asked, I'm sure we would have been told definitely that's a no-no.
Uh-huh.
But Val decided, you know, we got to do it. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the only right thing to do.
Uh-huh.
And we never were in any danger in that situation. Of course, it was the first time they'd ever seen white people or a vehicle, let alone the situation itself. But that was really the only situation of its kind that presented itself until a later time when I was in, this would have been in 66, when one of the villages where I was working.
One of the 16?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was working with a Lao guy who I became very friendly, very close with in that village, you know, building this well.
Mm-hmm.
And he and then the villagers, you know, worked and It's not this thing that's in the picture, because I remember the situation, but it was one of those wells that we built. And I remember being down in the hole digging with him and everything, and we got a message. Somebody came to the house, the compound where we were, and said that the village had been bombed.
While you were digging the well a little ways away?
Well, I was back in Moncal, village was
way
at the end of this, sort of at the end of the line.
Okay. I had an image of you two down in the well while the village is being bombed above you. Okay.
Had I been there, I would have known there was a bombing. But
yeah, yeah, and then the story just went whoops.
And so I drove right away. I think I was there alone at the time. I don't remember exactly, but I ended up going to the village in the Jeep. Got there probably about 2 hours after the bombing.
Uh-huh.
And the village was, there was a lot of devastation, and the people had, there was nobody around, there were some bodies, but then somebody saw me there and they came and said everybody's in the jungle,
mm-hmm.
and the survivors, and because they know and everybody knew that when it's the Americans bombing, they always come back and, you know, circle around and come back again. And as was the routine, particularly during the bombing in Vietnam, most of these bombing runs were, although as it turns out this one wasn't, but most of them were these Air Force guys that ended up with ordnance in their plane and they didn't want to land in Thailand at Udorn or wherever with any ordnance on the plane for obvious reasons. They might have an explosion and get blown up. So they would routinely fly over Laos and drop the bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was considered like, you know, chicken shooting. They just, who cared, you know? I mean, that was Laos, they were the enemy. But the case, in this particular case, was that the CIA had ordered this village to be bombed because it was contested. The village was considered sort of, could go either way, either towards the government or towards the...
So they wanted to push it over in the PL side.
That's right.
Yeah.
They
probably did a real good job of that bombing.
Really, but so I got in, I got to the, you know, I had to leave the vehicle and walk in to the jungle where the people were, and everybody ran away from me because they knew about that single sideband radio, and they thought, in their thinking, uh-huh. he called the bombing in on our village, right?
Yep.
Well, my friend, who had been to the compound many times with me, and, you know, we ate together and all,
uh-huh.
and we used to, you know, like to play on the radio, you know, and all this stuff, and I mean, we weren't supposed to, but we did, and so I let him play with the radio and all, and so he knew there wasn't any such thing. I mean, and he knew me,
yeah,
and he knew Val, and he knew mm-hmm. Terry, and he knew
your character, your person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we had learned the language, and all the other Americans never learned the language. They didn't eat the food. They didn't go to the villages or anything else except when, you know, the minister of this or that came with the American, you know, for a show off something. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, so he knew, and he basically said, no, you didn't, I know you didn't do that, but he died in my arms. And he died choking on the blood from the wounds. And he said, the last thing he said was that, he said, I didn't die for your country, I'm dying for my country. And, you know, I mean, I still can see him right now, I mean, you know, dying in my arms. I mean, it's something you just never forget. And, you know, people always ask me, how did you get into journalism, how did you get into interest in the CIA and everything? And I said, well, it was that moment, although I was sort of vicariously interested before that, thanks mm-hmm. to Pop Buell and so mm-hmm. forth, but that was almost 3 years before, but at that moment I decided that I had to you know, devote my life to researching the CIA and all, because they had done this bombing. Mm-hmm. And my friend died in my arms. And that, so that really was a very critical experience for me in my time in Laos. Also was the fact that I got malaria and dengue fever at Mung Cao. In fact, both Terry Collins and I doubt that it was the same mosquito, but we both came down with the same very rare form of malaria and dengue fever, both of us. And
same time?
Same time, we both went to the hospital. It could have been the same mosquito, but they usually say a mosquito bites once and it dies, right?
Well,
whatever it was, it was...
Could have been a brother.
I was, originally, he got sick after I did. I think I was the one who was very sick first, and then he came down with it too. And I was sent first to... went to see the doctor at the AID, you know, hospital or clinic, mm-hmm. whatever it was, and he was one of these guys that, you know, was living in the past, and you know, he'd give you a couple of pills and go home and take a nap or something, and you'll get better. But I was very sick, and then they decided to send me to Bangkok to the Seventh-day Adventist Hospital. And
get some real treatment there.
Yeah, or so we thought. And so they flew me down there, and that was turned out a very bad experience, which I can tell you more about, although I don't think it relates to IBS, but Seventh-day Adventist Hospital turns out it's not a very nice place. And
I thought it was fairly good. I've heard
of
other people.
Yeah, the rumor or the reputation is that they're the best doctors in Asia and all of this, but what they did to me and others there was quite different. I mean, maybe they have great doctors and a lot of machinery that you know, people in or even in the rest of Thailand, let alone the region, they don't have, but their religion gets in the way, and in my case, they don't let you, there's no meat served there, and they serve instead, which is fine. I don't eat meat anymore, but if you're not a vegetarian and you're mm-hmm. sick, like
mm-hmm.
I was,
mm-hmm.
you need food, you
mm-hmm.
need nourishment, you need something,
right.
And you don't need veggie burgers, which is what they served us. They
mm-hmm.
call them veggie burgers, and you know, why pretend it's meat if you don't like meat? They call them, you know, the menu actually had veggie burger on it. But then I had a spinal tap, and these four guys held me down, and the doctor says, he's putting the needle in, he says, now don't move or you'll die, because it's right on my spine,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that really scared the hell out of me, and it's a very painful experience. But the thing that really, really did the trick was when I, there was an American who was in a plane crash. He was not CIA, but a lot of his friends were, and he was in an Air America plane, and which the line was, it was a mechanical problem, but apparently the plane was shot down. He and one other person survived, everyone else killed. And this guy had injuries you wouldn't believe, and you know, so he had a full body cast and traction and everything, and they don't know that, you know, that you sign a contract when you come in with the hospital saying you will refrain from eating, you know, no meat and no smoking and no drinking, okay, no alcohol.
Well, smoking and drinking, that's
yeah.
okay.
Yeah.
The meat, I don't know, I agree. I mean, I haven't had red meat for a long time. But
anyway, so his friends from the embassy used to come in with a thermos bottle, right? And it wasn't tea.
Yes, right.
And it wasn't
coffee.
It wasn't juice. It was the hard stuff.
Yep.
And smoking away like, you know, anything. And
mm-hmm.
Then they'd put somebody at the door, and you close the door and watch out for people coming in and keep the windows open, the smoke
yeah.
would go out.
Yeah, yeah.
But one time, apparently, the surgeon came in and, you know, smoke was all over, and walked over and smelled the teacup.
Oh, yeah, you can't hide that stuff.
And he says, anyway, he walked over to the guy in traction and said, I just don't understand. He said, you signed this contract, you know, I mean, we've done nothing but treat you well here. We're putting you back together. I mean, you were seriously injured, and you're now getting better and recuperating, but then you do this. He said, you betrayed your trust with the hospital, blah, blah, blah. He said, I guess I'm just going to have to teach you a lesson. So he walked over and took his leg and twisted it like that. Now, I was two floors below.
Uh-huh.
He was up on the whatever floor. And I heard this blood-curdling scream. And within, you know, 20 minutes, it was all over the hospital what had happened. Right? Because the embassy people were there, and they were screaming and yelling. I mean, they couldn't believe they saw
this. They were in the same room.
Yeah. I saw it happen. Right?
Oh, wow.
And, you know,
so much for the Hippocratic Oath.
I mean, this guy was like somewhere out of Nazi Germany. I mean, it was just bizarre. And so I checked out of the hospital that afternoon. I mean, I wasn't going to wait around. I just walked. Mm-hmm. I picked up my bag and I was gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, they tried to convince me to stay. I said,
Not with the Nazi doctor upstairs.
I don't know what they're going to do to me after that, right? But who knows? And
even though you probably didn't smoke or
and
drink.
The spinal tap was a sort of a precursor to what was coming. So anyway, so I checked out. But I was still sick.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I went back to Laos.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't feeling right. Then I really came down with it. And they evacuated me to Clark Field.
Oh, uh-huh.
The Philippines. And, you know, and where the war was everywhere. I mean, you know, they were bringing these guys shot up and they were anything but treating venereal disease there. Yeah. I mean, that was the real thing. And these guys were left and right all over flying, dying around me and everything. There was so many people at that point. This would have been 66, and there was, you know, a lot of action in Vietnam, and every room was filled, but they had guys on gurneys, you know, up and down the hallway and everything. And they had determined that they had to operate on me because I had not only malaria and dengue, but I had gallstones at that point. And, you know, I had a severe problem, but I was in a lot of pain, but these other guys were legs and arms and everything shot up, and they clearly took a priority, so I was there about 3 days before I got my turn, right? And they were operating like 24 hours a day.
Yeah, not like they were sniffing you or anything.
No. And, you know, I was in a room with five or six guys, and, you know, a guy just dies. And I'm the last one he talks to, right? This was heavy for me at that time. After my experience in Laos, the guy dying in my arms, and all the CIA stuff going on around me, and just my tour of duty, you know, in Laos was, and here with this, it was the war, which I had never been told about that I was getting into in Laos, this was Vietnam guys, and, you know, they were flying missions in Laos too, some of them. They talked about it because I said, they said, where are you? And I said, I work in Laos. Oh, yeah, well, you just dropped some load over there last week, you know, something like this. So that was another, I mean, I wouldn't say I was preoccupied with war-related things, but it just, everywhere I looked, it was all around you. You couldn't miss it. Some of the volunteers in IVS, you know, they lived in another world. I mean, they were doing their thing, and they were almost totally missing this. When Don Luce and what's his name was out now in Chicago?
Gene,
yeah. Thank you. Gene and the other five or six people sent the open letter to President Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you remember it was on the front pages of the New York Times and everything. And they quit, they resigned, and they did their thing. That was another
mark thing for you too.
Yeah,
a big one.
Okay, we'll put it on pause. Let me get this back on. Yeah, no, we were talking about, well, you mentioned the your friend in Moncal and then the experience at
yeah,
Clark, and then
yeah,
finally
right,
the
right.
Lewis and Stolfitz,
yeah.
And
that yeah, that experience when they resigned, and a number of us in Laos were very concerned about IVS's role and what was going on in Laos, and how the IVS program was basically dictated by AID,
mm-hmm.
by Washington. All the projects that we were doing were seemingly coming out of Washington as opposed to IVS's. And then, of course, there was this conflict, a quite natural conflict, because we were contracted to AID, so therefore we were supposed to, at least on paper, do whatever AID wanted done. But, you know, in practice, in reality, when you get right down to it on the village level, it became very obvious very quickly, very early in my experience there, and to everyone in different places, you know, different people always had this gripe that, you know, that program that they've dreamed up in Washington bears no relationship to the needs of the Lao people that we work with. And
mm-hmm.
So that was constantly, always coming to the surface, in both in education programs and in rural development. Whose priorities is it? Is it the Lao or is it the Americans? You know, and of course with our organizational and individual idealism and what we felt we were there to do at considerable sacrifice, you know. We weren't making the money that AID
mm-hmm.
people were making. We weren't, and we chose that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
And that was a
yeah.
conscious decision, but at the same time,
if you're going to give, you want it
yeah.
to be for something.
Right.
I'm sorry, I'm putting words.
Well, that's the way I felt, and there was, of course, this reality of these hundreds of Americans all over the place, some who were there officially and others who weren't, and in my own case, in our own case, we used to see these Americans in civilian clothes, all of them nice khaki pants and pressed plaid shirts and everything, and very quickly you learned that those weren't AID people. I mean, the AID people, we always knew them by name. Or
the true AID
yeah,
people.
Yeah, right. And there were all these others there, and
mm.
whether it was in Vientiane,
reflector shades,
yeah, and they all had air-conditioned cars,
mm-hmm.
or they had, or when we met them or didn't meet them personally, but saw them in the field,
Broncos,
or they had fancy Jeeps with huge tires and all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were working with a Jeep with a winch on the front. You know, the winch is out of
mm-hmm.
Whenever we get stuck in the mud, which was, you know, every third day usually during the rainy season. And, you know, these guys didn't know how to deal with situations that they came up against. So they immediately got on their radio and their walkie-talkies and all of that. So we knew who they were and what they were. I mean, the rule was avoid these people at all costs, don't have anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this was at a time when increasingly, it became clear what was going on, clear to us, but, you know, back in Washington, it was a big secret that there was
mm-hmm.
this huge paramilitary operation in Laos. And it stayed a secret until 1971, when Senator Fulbright held his public hearings. And we were in Laos. We're all faced with this war. I mean, I had sort of, and several other IVSers had more come up against it more than maybe some of the other IVSers, which, you know, were confined to somewhat, you know, traditional situation, working situation, or the Dong Dok people didn't really face that, although in a way they did too, because Dong Dok was at some times was placed on security alert because of the Pathet Lao every now and then on the road out of Yanchan, north of Dongduk, was sort of a questionable area every now and then. They were in secret. So they were they were aware of it, but they didn't really face it. I mean, it was nobody ever saw the Pot Tet Lao there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as we were concerned, the bigger danger within the Pot Tet Lao was the Lao military when they got drunk and they had their weapons and they used to go like this with their weapons, you know, with the safety off, you know, and the things twirling around and they carry it like a piece of meat, you know, and they were to us the real threat, not the Pot Tet Lao.
Sounds like the PC.
Yeah, exactly.
We always feared the PC much more than the NPA.
For a good reason.
Yeah.
And one thing the Lao military did with in abundance was get drunk. I mean, they were drunk more than they were sober. Yeah. And screwing around with the women and everything.
Sounds
else.
Like the PC again. Are you sure that it's not the same guy? You're not mixing the countries,
mixing
are you?
Countries. Yeah. Yes, it's true there. I can't deny that. That's. But no, I'm talking in this case about the Lao military.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other dichotomy was the fact
I got more tapes. I can keep on going forever.
Well, I won't go on forever, but I'll sign. I don't think I can finish in a half hour. But
I got a couple more tapes. I always over prepare. Because one time I had a tape that got hung up. Okay. So if I would have only brought like one or two tapes, I would have been a deep do. So now I always pack extra.
was that the U.S. was working obviously much more with a higher priority with the secret war.
Mm-hmm.
And that was above and beyond any work with the Lao military, the Royal Lao government, which was they were trying to supposedly keep in power,
mm-hmm.
but not through working with the Royal Lao military, Royal Lao Army. It was, and to the extent there was one, the Royal Lao Air Force, but the Air Force was the guys flying in T-28s
mm-hmm.
with the CIA. And
or cargo planes for opium.
Well, I was going to touch on that too.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
And,
don't want to preempt to use the war works.
the priority, of course, being in the north, and Xinguang and
mm-hmm.
the so-called and along the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the east. And you know, I used to, and we all used to, and at least in the rural areas, used to constantly see that. The B-52 flying over
mm-hmm.
to Vietnam, and then flying back,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it was
occasionally dumping stuff.
Yeah, well, B-52s usually dump everything on their
on their one thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So then. After my bout with malaria and dengue fever and gallstones, I mean, I was very sick.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, they said I had 105.8 temperature at one point in Bangkok. I remember the doctor saying we could have fried an egg on your forehead.
Mm.
I mean, wow. And so I was really a sick guy. And I mean, I don't think I brushed with death, but I was very sick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I come out of that, and Chet Brown and the AID people said, he probably shouldn't go out in the rural areas again. If you get it again, this time it could kill him. You know, they were afraid of somebody dying. I mean, meanwhile, the IVSers were getting killed, as happened in Vietnam and happens twice or three times in Laos. There was an IVS who was killed in Mong Palan. Was killed when they Pot Tet Lao. He really shouldn't have been there. It was a forward area.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was one of these guys that wasn't a Fred Carlson type. He was really sincere about what he was doing, and he wanted to stay there, and so they told him check in every, you know, instead of twice a day. I think he had to check in four times a day on this radio and everything, and they came in one night underneath this house and shot him in his sleep underneath through the floor. And then the incident that I told you about was not an IVSer, but it was somebody very close, which they denied that that was their bombing. I mean, who else could it be, right?
They who?
I mean, this case never happened as far as they were concerned. And it happened when an American is killed, but when it's Lao, you know, so what? It's
basically you're speaking vague reference. I mean, a Laotian co-worker killed by...
Not paid by IBS, but he was...
Yeah, a local official working as a counterpart.
We had Lao who worked with us.
Right, and then there were counterparts that you might have with the government. This guy was perhaps with the
government.
He wasn't
government, no.
Okay, all right, then...
No, in fact, I concluded... I sort of knew, but didn't really acknowledge it in my own mind before he was killed, but after he was killed, I started reflecting on him, and we were very close, but I knew sort of that he sided with the Pathet Lao.
Oh, so that was the government who killed him?
It was the Americans that killed him.
Okay, American then, okay.
You were making they considered the whole village Pathet Lao. I mean, it's lost as far as they were, the Americans were concerned. It could go either way, they thought, but... They figured, I mean, in their way of thinking, if the Pathet Lao could come into a village at will, then they controlled that village. And it was, as far as they were concerned, you know, beyond the pale.
That's faulty thinking.
Well, it was the same thinking that applied to the forward area program, except in the forward area program, they considered a much more, they considered those areas much more strategic, I guess. To their program, whatever that was. I forget his name. The guy who was in charge of the forward area program was an ex-Marine, a real, real heavy, you know, macho guy who loved to shoot him up and really was into Marine expeditionary type operations and thinking, and he was an AID guy, but ostensibly. For all I know, he really was. I don't know, but he seemed out of place in AID, and he was running the forward area program. I always think of his name, but today I can't think of his name. I can see his face. Anyway, the whole forward area program, which IVS had somehow been drawn into, which many of us questioned as well, just was completely out of sync with what IVS should have been doing. And I guess I always wondered how Chet and I guess IVS Washington had been allowed itself to be brought into that. I mean, if they needed to do this program, they needed to find other people, not us. But then there were IVSers that, you know, wanted to do this. Either adventurists, Fred Carlson people, type of people, or people whose idealism sort of took precedence over everything else. And
idealism? You mean patriotism, sort of idealism?
No, idealism in terms of they would sort of block out the forward area concept. Saving these villages from communism, quote unquote, right? And they would see that their duty was to help people help themselves, which was IVS's motto. And you know, they refused. I mean, it was sort of a self-denial thing that they were dealing with. And it had to be. I mean, we were. Let's face it, it's like me working with Pop Buell. All those people in those situations must have felt, to a greater or lesser extent, you know, what am I doing here? And some did it willingly, and some, you know, were assigned to it, and, you know, they basically saluted, and figuratively, the boss, whether it was Jet Brown or whether it was AID, and did what they were told. But when people started getting killed, like the guy was shot in his bed, and then in the case, this was after, was it after Don Luce and et al., Gene and the rest of them resigned? I can't remember if it was before or after. There was a guy, Max Sinclair. Do you know the name?
No.
He was killed in Vietnam.
I might have seen it on a list, but I can't. I haven't heard much about
Max,
it.
Max, I went over to Vietnam. Don Luce invited me, and you can talk with Don about it. When he was leaving Vietnam, after he'd been there, what was it, 12 years, or I forget how many years, years, I mean, he was there longer than anybody, all with IBS, and he was, like, loved there. I mean, they had so many Vietnamese friends and everything, and obviously spoke fluent, wrote fluently and read Vietnamese, and knew much more than most of the Americans who were there knew about Vietnam from a people's level as opposed to, you know, looking at it from Washington's standpoint. And so he invited me over. I mean, God, what a honor to go around with him on his last time around, visiting all these places all over Vietnam as he was leaving the country. And we stayed at these different places with different IBS people along the way, and stayed with him. And one of them was Max Sinclair. We stayed overnight in his place where he was working. I can't remember exactly where it was. I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Oh, yeah, well, it was a quick tour, so.
I think it was in the Delta, but I'm not really sure. And what a wonderful guy. I mean, truly, you know, the epitome of IBS. Here's this guy who had given up. He was an agriculturalist from Indiana, rural Indiana, and which coincidentally, obviously only coincidentally, was where Pop Buell was from. And, you know, learned the language, he ate the food, he did everything that IBSers do. And he worked in areas, apparently, it turned out, that NLF was in and out of all the time. And he, to some extent, like Don, you know, didn't let that get in the way. And, you know, for him, that was irrelevant. And his idea was to work with people that needed help, and irrespective of what the Americans were really doing there, which was destroying the country. According to the eyewitnesses, he was driving, and he had wasn't a Jeep, it was a, what do you call it, a British...
Land Rover?
Land Rover, yeah. He had a Land Rover, and I guess it was AID issue or whatever, and struck head-on by an army, one of these huge army tractor trailers, a truck, a large, you know, huge vehicle. According to the eyewitnesses, I mean, the official story was that he fell asleep at the wheel and went off the road. But the eyewitnesses said that the car was, you know, rammed by an army truck. He was killed. And I and Don and everyone who knew Max, and he was a very conscientious guy. I mean, sure, there was a chance that he could have fallen asleep at the wheel. Obviously, he worked very hard and everything, but the eyewitness' story was very different than the Vietnamese. But, of course, nobody believes the Vietnamese. They can't be trusted, right? I mean, in the Americans' terms. I went back on my... I guess when I came back on home leave, which was October 66, so it must have been close to that it happened, I guess. I don't remember the date, but, or was it after I left IBS in 67? No, but then I stayed in the Philippines, so it must have been October when I came on my home leave. I went out to Indianapolis and, you know, went back where I had lived before, and then I went to this town, this rural place in Indiana, I visited his farm, his family's farm. I got the address from IBS, you know, and went there. I didn't tell them why, but I went, you know, to the farm, and I introduced myself as having stayed overnight with their son, and sorry I was. And, you know, I'm standing there in this farmhouse on the porch, and, you know, they weren't inviting me into the house, and not that I felt the need to, but I just wanted to say how bad I felt that their son had been killed, and
mm-hmm.
I said thank you, and they were very cordial, but short. And I said, you know, I don't believe the official story of why he was killed, but there are Vietnamese eyewitnesses who said, in fact, the car was rammed by an army truck. At which point they said, sort of going like this, I don't want to know. I said, don't you want to know how your son died, or why, or
mm-hmm.
how? I said, no. And then Mr. Sinclair said, they told us not to talk to anybody. I said, they? Who was they? The government. I said, please, thank you very much for coming. Good day. Shut the door. And so I've always, and Max Sinclair's name is not on the wall, Vietnam
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Memorial, like a number of other IBSers who were killed. Okay. The same with the guy in Mong Palan. And there was an IBSer who was captured by the Vietnamese
uh-huh.
and executed, as I remember. One was released. There's a book about it by
Mark Kaye.
Yeah, right.
Let me put it on pause.
Yeah.
Now I've got it back on again. It's on record. I was asking you which guy was executed.
I think he was, as I remember, he was French.
Well, that
and
was the guy who
in
was...
in Mark Kaye's book. Wasn't he? Or,
no,
there were several people, but he was the other person who was either executed or killed somehow. I don't know.
Well, Kaye was picked up with an American volunteer he was with.
Yeah.
And then for a while, I guess they were together, and then Kaye doesn't talk about him any longer, as if that guy might have been taken to some other place. He just sort of disappears from the narrative, and I was going to ask Don about that.
He's the better, more authoritative
yeah.
person on that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I know about people in Laos, but I guess I don't know as much except about Max.
I think his name was Davies or something like that. So where the hell he go? Because there was also a woman, Johnson, I believe her name was, who was picked up in the same time because of Ted.
Mm.
Kept for 3 months, but they let her go. They had no
mm.
place for a woman. And so they probably just said, bad PR, let's just get rid of the woman, you know, because she's obviously
that book
hot.
About Mark Kaye is very powerful, I mean, about his experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it is. I don't, well, I've had French, I can get through French, but I was happy to find it, the English translation.
Mm.
You know, so, let's see, let me ask you a couple of things, a couple of questions that had occurred to me while we were going, while you were talking, that I wanted to get back to. Both of them are, in a sense, to help us in our compare and contrast between both Laos and Vietnam. Much earlier, you were talking about the use of IVS by AID for the goals that they, AID, had devised, whether it's in Washington or more local, but nonetheless not in sync with what the people wanted, and or certainly not inspired by the people's demands or even consultation, I would assume. This flies against the idea of the self-help concept, as I understand it, where it's the people who are to be consulted, where they have to develop an agenda, and then they say, yes, we do want a schoolhouse, we do not want a well, we do not want a clinic, so we'll need, you know, this amount of concrete, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the outside intervener, whether it's IBS or AID or Peace Corps or whatever, can then try to help them get the material goods. How did it really work in your experience in Laos? Was it how much involvement of villagers in their own decision making was generated?
I think it varied from IBS location to one to the next. I mean,
even within Laos.
Yeah, very much so, and also it varied because due to the degree of ego that was involved at the AID level, and the character of the particular what are they called, area coordinators.
Okay.
In our case, in Mong Cao, what's his name? George Daly was a very laid-back kind of guy. I mean, he was an AID man, even an IBSer. I'm not sure, was he originally an IBSer or not? I might have been, but...
I don't think he was.
He was a pretty cool guy, but at the same time, he had a lot of demands on him from AID's standpoint. For the most part, since Bac San and the areas that I was working, or that we were working, the three of us were not contested areas except that one village.
Right. The one that was bombed.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in certain other areas of Laos where IBS worked certainly played a role in this. And again, it was always the strategic question as far as AID was concerned. That is, how far away are the communists? I mean, I hate to put it in those terms, but that's, I mean, I was never sitting in an AID meeting, but it was very, very clear that that was the agenda, fighting the communists as opposed to what they saw as communists. They hardly knew what the Pathet Lao were about, let alone whether they were communists or what. I mean, I think they were, and there was no question, but that was irrelevant, the fact that they had, the Pathet Lao were much more popular and had a mass of support from a large sector of the population, whereas the Royal Lao government that the U.S. was so closely identified with was only had support, political or popular support, to a very minimal extent. I mean, it had support in the sense that the government, with U.S. help, controlled certain sector of Laos, the corridor, the corridor close to the Mekong, and going inland to an extent, but the river being here and going inland to a certain extent. But the popular support of the Lao government was more in terms of patronage and how much they could get from the Americans and so forth. Whereas the support that the Pathet Lao had was much more, I think, than skin deep. So the programs that we, IBS, were expected to implement were largely sort of in tandem or in parallel with the strategic objectives of the U.S. And every now and then there was some genuine needs, felt needs, as it were, in quotes, expressed by the Lao about a project that they wanted. I don't mean the Lao government, but the village level. We largely worked, again, because it was a very top-down type of system at that time, before 1975, where, people were always very, very much the Chao Kuang, who was effectively the governor, the equivalent of the governor, and then the Chao Mong, who was effectively the mayor, or equivalent to a mayor, except in a rural context, were the people that set the terms in many ways. And a lot of, on a local level, a lot of people were very paid attention first to them, particularly the Chau Mung, because he lived in the area.
Right at hand, yeah.
Whereas the Chau Quang, they almost never saw the Chau Quang, except on a ceremonial or a holiday occasion. And then it was always at a distance, whereas they used to at least know the Chau Mung and could talk to them. And then the Chau Mung sort of acted in many cases as the person that we IBS would deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we tended to, on our own, from our own side of IBSers, we tended to do both. We realized that we had to work through the Chau Mung, and we were sensitive to that. But we tried to influence the Chau Mung by working with the villagers who would then go to the Chau Mung. So it was a circle, circular sort of round robin thing. And the Chau Mung also could bring certain concerns to AID that maybe would mean more to AID coming from him than from us. So we sort of were playing that sort of power game.
Politics.
Yeah, right.
Kind of a politics with a small P.
I mean, Val, particularly Val Peterson, was an expert at that, playing that whole thing. And he played it just like a violin. I mean, he really knew how to do that. And I sort of learned watching him and working with him and that. You know, there was also the problem that a lot of the commodities that AID was sending in were source of some real tensions. For example, bulgur wheat. I'm sure you've read about bulgur wheat.
Oh, God, yes, we had that.
I mean, they had all this millions of tons of bulgur wheat that they wanted to give away, and it was partly to appease farmers in this country who were getting price supports and everything else, and nobody eats bulgur wheat in the United States, and so it was all for these, quote, people-to-people programs with a handshake on the burlap bags and everything else. So there was the bulgur wheat that never in the entire time I was there, and I'm sure any other IBS people, and the supplies also in Vietnam, were we ever able to successfully introduce bulgur wheat into the diet there. I mean, it was always, I mean, we were asking people to feed this to their babies, right?
Oh.
Bulgur wheat, and these babies would choke on this, let alone the adult population. And
we made pancakes.
Yeah.
You could make pancakes. We did that in the Philippines.
But a lot of it was so rotten by the time it got to Laos and, you know, full of bugs and boll weevils and all kinds of stuff. And
pigs love it.
Yeah. So exactly, that's where it ended up in our case.
Uh-huh.
It always got fed to the pigs. Whether we fed it to the pigs or whether Lao did. I mean,
when we had good bulgur wheat, it would be pancakes.
Yeah.
Usual bulgur wheat would be pig food. Or chicken food
and like that. You know, it was always such a bad signal that we were sending to the Lao that, you know, what they needed was rice.
Yeah.
And not the Erie variety, because it didn't hold up to the
sticky standard.
Not only wasn't it sticky, but it couldn't take the wind, and it couldn't take the heavy rains, and it couldn't.
Oh, as far as planting. Okay, I thought you meant just
for. And it required heavy use of fertilizers and insecticides, which they didn't have. I mean, we were providing in large part and totally the insecticides, but you know, this was a totally alien to them. I mean, it gave them somewhat increased yield, but the flip side was that we were asking them to do a lot more work. And not always get the yield. The yield was not guaranteed. It depended a lot on flooding conditions, on the rats, on the bugs. And every year it was a different infestation of insects that you could never predict or know what this would effect this would have on their yield. And so, you know, it was all kinds of human relations problems that we were introducing to the situation by demanding that they take these seeds from the Philippines, the so-called miracle rice, as we were asked to call it, and most of the IBSers just called it, you want to try this new variety. You know, we used to call it a miracle because when it didn't turn out to be a miracle, they'd as they believe in miracles anyway, they're into spirit worship, and so You know, it just introduced all kinds of unnecessary and theretofore unknown problems into the equation of our working with the law. Then, of course, the other commodity that caused problems was cement, because the cement that we would get more times than not was hard as a rock, was totally unusable. And, you know, we'd have to check off how many bags of cement we got, irrespective of how much of it we could use, right?
Mm-hmm.
And 9 times out of 10, at least some of it, usually more than half of it, was already past. You can't like chop it up in little pieces and use it. It has to be powder, or mm-hmm. Forget it.
Yeah, right? If it's already been solidified by humidity, it's
or rain
or whatever.
They used to leave it out on the tarmac in Vientiane, and come in, you know, on these huge air star lifter planes and everything, you know, by the.
Wouldn't even have a tarp over?
Sometimes, yeah. Oh, if they got around to it. Or they'd be, you know, they'd unload it in the rain. Well, I mean,
yeah, it's going to pick up some moisture there for sure. Yeah.
You know, because the Air Force needs the plane back, right, for the war, right? So, I mean, it was always that. And then, of course, the last problem came up. Well, there are many other problems, of course, but the one that I remember was Pop Buell's famous program that he was going to introduce of when it became, and I was going to come to the question of opium, was to show his goodwill when the secret war became an open, known quantity when I was still there in by 66, 67, and among the Americans there. So as a public relations, or an attempt at public relations, Pop Buell suggested, and coming from Pop Buell, who was supposed to really, you know, here's the guy that's in the middle of things, and he knows what he's doing and everything. But of course, having worked with him, I knew some more about him than most people. But anyway,
he was going again.